It's a pleasure to be here this evening. My wife, Patricia, and I drove up from San Antonio, Texas, where it was, I think the day we left, the next day was 92 degrees. The blue bonnets are in blossom. You know, spring is gone. We're, you know, into the first days of summer. I was really surprised coming up here. I really thought the price of gasoline would have gone up more than it did, but it was about $3.35 a gallon in San Antonio and held pretty steady all the way up here. I have a good friend in San Antonio who is sort of a country philosopher, and he has theories about everything. And he told me the other day, he said, I have a theory on why gasoline prices always rise and they never seem to go down again. And I've got to humor this guy because, you know, sometimes his theories are really pretty weird. And I said, well, what's your theory? And he said, well, the theory is that we don't check our oil level often enough as a nation. And I said, you know, I don't understand anything about that at all. He says, well, you know how you check your oil in your truck? I said, yeah. He said, well, you go out and you raise the hood, you pull a dipstick out, you wipe it off, you stick it back in the hole, and you pull it out and check and see if you need to add oil or not. And he said, that's how you do it for your truck. And he says, but we don't do that as a nation. And I said, you know, I still don't understand a darn thing you're telling me. And he said, well, he said, think about it now. He said, all our oil is in Alaska. He said, Gulf of Mexico. He said, we have oil in Louisiana and Texas and Oklahoma. I said, yeah, I understand that. And he said, and all the dipsticks are in Washington, D.C. But I'm delighted to be here this evening. I thank all of you for putting on the little bit of snow this afternoon. I can't wait to get back to San Antonio and tell them about this huge snowstorm we went through up in Dayton, Ohio. I've narrowed down the topic of my talk tonight to a very specific period of time. And that's a Wild Weasel Operations, excuse me, I'm wrong button, of course. That happened at Tockley Royal Thai Air Force Base, and during a specific period of time, and those were the months that I was there, and that was from July of 1966 to May of 1967. And we're going to talk about these guys right here. This was my Wild Weasel class. Was class 3-2, 3 being 105s and 2 being the second class. And what happened to this group of people. And to a lesser extent, in War Story Number 2, we're going to talk about these guys. This is the 354th TAC Fighter Squadron. This was taken in about April of 1967. That some people there that's me right. Well, fumble fingers here. That's me right there in the back. That's Merle Dethelson, Medal of Honor recipient right there. Squadron Commander, Lieutenant Colonel Phil Gast, who retired as a 3-star general. And let's see, Max Brestel, MiG Killer. Good bunch of people, and we'll talk a little bit about them. But for those of you who may not know what the Wild Weasel program was, in 24th of July 1965 was the first time a surface-to-air missile was used in combat to shoot down an enemy airplane, and it shot down an Air Force F-4, damaged another pretty badly. It caused a lot of consternation. We had known that the missiles were being put into North Vietnam for months ahead of time. The chairman of the Central Intelligence Agency and the chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff all recommended to President Lyndon Johnson that the sites be destroyed before they became operational. And President refused to do so. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, refused to take that recommendation to the President even. The State Department guy at the time, one guy was quoted as saying, well, you don't think they're going to really use those missiles to shoot at you, do you? You know? And, you know, you sort of wish that he had been there. A year later, we could have sent him up there and see if they had shot. But there were a bunch of committees that were formed. One was the main one, as far as I'm concerned, was the Dempster Committee, run by a Brigadier General K.C. Dempster, who was a World War II veteran who was running one of the research and development divisions at the Pentagon. Joint Chiefs of Staff had their group. They called theirs Prong Tong. The Tactical Air Warfare Center at Eglin Air Force Base had a group of people together to try to figure out how to handle the missile problem, as did Pacific Air Force Headquarters. And a lot of the same people were on all these committees, and some of the conclusions that they came up to was that, well, we needed radar warning receivers on all our fighter aircraft. We need some jammers for them. And one thing which was interesting was that they needed timely processing of photographic intelligence. It turned out that this was well before Polaroid film, if you can remember this. So when an airplane flew over a target and took a picture of something happening, by the time he got back to his base and, the staff sergeant went out and he undid the Zeus fasteners and took the camera out and fastened it back up and took it to the Photoshop to be developed. And by the time a person finally looked at the developed film and tried to figure out what was on there, flagged something as being an important thing that someone needed to know about. By the time copies of the film were made, it was taken out and put on a T-39 aircraft and taken to the base that needed that intelligence information, it was not unusual for 3 days to have transpired. The particular SAM site, a surface-to-air missile site that shot down the F-4, when it was shot down, no one knew that missile site was there, when in fact it had been photographed 2 days before. It's just that the photograph hadn't been processed. So, and they needed a SAM killer, a surface-to-air missile killer, and that's where the wild weasel came into being. The committee came up with some other really weird recommendations. They gave some briefings to the heads of General Electric and Westinghouse and, all the big defense industries, and got these heads together. And actually someone came up with a recommendation of taking surplus B-47s, making them into drones, loading them up with high explosives, and going in there and crashing them into the SAM sites. And that obviously wasn't chosen, but the SAM killer was a wild weasel program. It initially was done with F-100 aircraft. I'm not going to talk about that. That's a wonderful story in itself. I'm going to talk about the F-105. And in about May of 1966, I had just completed a 9-month TDY in the island of Guam and B-52s flying arc light missions in South Vietnam, and managed to get in the Wild Weasel program. And there's some comparisons which I'll make a little bit later about how Strategic Air Command and B-52 crews were treated versus the circumstances that the 105 guys lived under. And there's a stark contrast. The training was short. We started out with 10 days at Long Beach International Airport. We showed up there with 8 pilots and 8 electronic warfare officers. I was an electronic warfare officer from Strategic Air Command, as I said. The only thing that I remember about that training was that in the first day we got in there and the instructor asked for everyone to stand up and tell something about themselves. Where were you born? Where are you from? Are you married? How many kids do you have? How long have you been flying airplanes? Where have you been stationed? And everybody in the, all 16 of us got up and said who we were and told a little bit something about us. And the guy said, we're going to take a coffee break at the end when everybody's has given their introduction. And at the end of the coffee break, you come back in, and you're going to pick out who you're going to fly with. And you're going to go through your whole training program with this guy. And so you better pick carefully, and you're going to fly your whole 100 missions with that person. So surprisingly, with this poor choice of this poor selection process, generally it worked out pretty well. I wound up teamed with a guy by the name of Ed Larson, a longtime F-105 guy. And we were both former enlisted guys, so maybe that was the reason that we picked each other out. He had been in security service as a Morse code operator. I had been a jet engine mechanic in B-36s and B-47s. So we picked each other out. We decided, you know, we'd fly together. And it was sort of interesting. The flamboyant people sort of tended to go together, you know, and I guess they're, you know, sort of a chemical attraction there. But anyway, we all joined up and we had some more classes that day. And that night we all went to, they had a hospitality room for us at the motel we were staying at, which was my first experience with a hospitality suite run by North American Aviation. So there was, you know, some adult beverages there. And it was really pretty interesting. We had a few drinks, and then we went out and got in the car, went out to a restaurant to eat. And Ed was sitting across the table from me. And, you know, we gave our orders, and, you know, the soup course came, and I looked over, and there's this guy that I'm going to fly 100 missions sound asleep with his face about an inch from his bowl of soup. And I thought, what in the hell have I got myself into here? But it turned out he was really an excellent pilot. He just had a tendency to fall asleep a lot. Anyway, we went from there to Nellis Air Force Base, and had a six-week course. We were way at the end of the flight line. Those of you that were at Nellis years ago, the Thunderbird hangar used to be way at the end of the flight line there, and where the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds used to hang out when they weren't flying air shows. And they had an upper balcony there that was vacant, and that's where we had our classes. The instructors that we had were the guys who were in the F-100 Wild Weasel program, and most of them had been overseas you know, and flown some missions. Some of them had killed SAM sites. A whole lot of them had not, but they were the best instructors available. I remember one class they were talking, someone was giving a lecture about surface-to-air missiles, about the missile itself. I remember him saying, well, he said, you know, if you're going to go in and try to find this missile site and shoot at it, chances are you're going to get shot at yourself. You know, the missile is going to shoot at you. And he said, but don't worry about that because, you know, you can dodge them with your airplane. He said, you can really dodge. They're easy to dodge. And, you know, it seemed like the guy was awfully glib, you know, and almost to the point of being flippant. And somebody raised their hand because he said, well, you wait till the missile gets really close and you pull up really hard and turn into it and it'll miss you. And somebody raised their hand and said, well, how close do you let it get before you do that? And this guy got this real blank look on his face. And it was obviously he had never done this. You know, he had heard someone else say that you could do this. And he sat there and he thought a little bit and he said, well, you'll know. And surprisingly, he was right. You know, you know. But we had some flights. As I say there, we had some trike launches. We had a standoff missile, we'd call it. I'd put that in quotes, standoff. An anti-radiation missile, which we were to use to shoot against the radar sites. We didn't have enough of them, so the majors got to fire the shrike, and we didn't, you know. So the captains, we were captains, and, you know, there were a couple crews with captains on them. We didn't get to fire one because, you know, there weren't enough of them. So anyway, that part of the program really sucked. We deployed to, we left our training completed to Tak Lee, Thailand on the 3rd of July, 1966, arrived on the 4th of July, 1966. Now, I thought when I was putting this presentation together, well, maybe somebody doesn't know where Thailand is, you know. And so here it is on this map here. And here's Japan, here's China, Russia, India, and this is Thailand right here. And about where under the T is there in Thailand is about where Tok Le Royal Thai Air Force Base is. And the missions that we were going to fly, of course, were here into the area of North Vietnam right here. So that's where it is. Now you all know where Thailand is when I talk about it. We arrived there, as I said, the 4th of July, 1966. We had been flying. We ferried our aircraft over. We had 6 airplanes, 8 crews. 2 crews went ahead, you know, on by KC-135s to get everything set up for us. So we arrived there the 4th of July, 1966. We flew from Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas, Nevada, to Sacramento, to one of the air material areas to get some modifications done to our airplanes, and we headed out with tankers and flew to Hickam, Hawaii. We stopped. We got drunk in Hickam, Hawaii. We got up the next morning, and we flew from Hickam to Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. And we sort of did the same thing there. You know, we were young guys full of testosterone going to war, going to show our stuff, you know. And so the second day we were at Anderson Air Force Base, Guam. The next leg of the journey was from there to Okinawa. And we stopped and we got drunk there. And then flew down, stopped at Saigon for a little bit, and then flew on into to Thailand. So we weren't in very good shape when we got there. One of our guys there in the wing commander was there giving his welcome briefing, and one of the guys was in the front row, and he was much the worse for wear after, you know, this 4 days of flying and imbibing, and fell asleep during the briefing, and the wing commander absolutely went ballistic. I mean, he just really, reacted inappropriately, and we almost were sent off the base right there. But I want to talk to you about some of the challenges. You know, every organization that ever went into war had their own challenges and unique challenges. And I want to tell you about those that we faced here in Tok Le, Thailand. And I'm going to talk about each one of these. Restrictive rules of engagement, what our living conditions were like, the equipment that we had, and its suitability for the tasks that we had. Munitions shortcomings and shortages, because that was really important. The rules of engagement, you know, have been talked about probably in every presentation there's ever been given about the Vietnam Air War, so I won't dwell on them here. But just to say that, you know, some of them here, there were prohibited areas around Hanoi and Haiphong, the two major cities in North Vietnam, that you couldn't even fly over them. You couldn't go into these areas. The harbors and the ships were off limits. You know, it was not a declared war. Some of the ships coming into the harbor were Dutch, were French, were British. All bringing supplies in there, they were off limits, of course. And I saw a picture in intelligence one day. I went in there, and there was a loading area off the harbor there in Haiphong, and they're in canisters like an engine canister comes in, you know. There were probably 300 canisters with surf-to-air missiles in them and had been downloaded off the ships and were there ready for, to be transshipped to a missile site somewhere. Excellent target. Boy, wouldn't you love to go hit that? But it was on the restricted target list. So instead of taking out those 300 missiles when they were sitting there in the canister, you know, you went in and you flew in the airplane and you took them on one at a time, you know, which is really is a shame. The third bullet there is a statement attributed to Lyndon Johnson. I've never been able to track it down to see if he really said this or when he said it, but it sure sounds like something that he said, you know. And that them boys can't hit an outhouse without my say-so. And there were restrictions on airfields. We flew by, the airfields on the way up going to a target. You fly by Kapper, one of the other airfields, and you'd even see MiGs taxiing out, ready to come up and take off and come after you. The rules of engagement were so restrictive that you couldn't attack those MiGs until they were off the ground and had their wheels in the well. Now, who the hell thought of that? You know, that's just terrible. But the rules. We also had you couldn't attack another aircraft without visual identification first. And that, again, goes back to a lot of the aircraft going in there were aircraft belonging to people that were allies of us, you know, in another conference or something, in another treaty. And so, our air-to-air fighters gave up their advantage of beyond visual range missiles by having to wait up, you know, close in on the guy, see that he was in fact a big 17 or big 19, back up again, you know, to get back and where you were in range of the missiles. So a lot of stuff there that was really, you know, poorly done. I want to talk about our living conditions a little bit. Sleep and food. Probably things that we all take for granted, right? You know, we're going to be someplace and we're going to have some living conditions that are really nice. I talked to you about being in Guam in 1965. Larry the Muse in the crowd here, and he was there with me at the same time. We were flying missions into South Vietnam, and we had nice air-conditioned quarters. We had plenty of food. We flew about one day out of three. So the other 2 days, the blue bus pulled up in front of the barracks at 8 o'clock in the morning. We got our golf clubs and we got on the bus, and it took us across the island to the Navy golf course. And we played 36 holes of golf, and the bus came and picked us up at 5 o'clock and took us back, and we went to the club and had a few drinks and some food. Now, contrast to this, a year later, you know, here we are in Thak Le, Thailand, at one of the premier fighter bases. This is it. Sort of nice, isn't it? You know, it's made out of teak, you know, so it's sort of high class. But this is the hooch that we lived in. These panels on the side here, if it's raining really hard and the wind is blowing straight, you go out and you drop the panels down, you know, and it keeps the moisture out. The rest of the time, to get a little airflow, these panels that are along here and those along the side here, you raise them up and see this board here, and there's one there, you raise it up and you stick the board in the corner there to keep the panel up and allow a little air circulation to go through there. Inside this hooch, there are about 10 bunks down each side there and about 4 big ceiling fans hanging from the ceiling there. And that's it. 10 bunks have got racks on them and mosquito netting because there's a lot of malaria over there. So. But anyway, and what happens when you fly airplanes all day long? They have to be fixed at night. So at night, about a mile away is the maintenance area, and they run engines almost all night long. So part of the reason, and I'm going to show you some loss figures for the weasels and for as well as for the wing at the time. Part of the reason, I think, anyway, just my personal experience from being there, that the loss rates were so high was actually aircrew fatigue. You know, that, the only saving grace was that drinks at the bar were 15 cents. So, you can only, do that very long, for only a short period of time, even young people like we were then. So, but no air-conditioned quarters. There were a few trailers, that some of the field-grade people had, the majors had. But, the rest of us guys were in these things, and not a very conducive environment for, being very rested. We were out of food for a good period of this time. I remember one morning after coming back from a sortie, and I went to the We ate at the officers' club. It was air-conditioned. And the waitresses were all young Thai girls, all very proper. You know, I don't think I ever saw any hanky-panky going off between the Thai girls and the fighter pilots while I was there. I think they were all from fairly good families. They spoke broken English. They had a weird sense of humor. And I remember going in there for lunch, and I went in and I looked at the menu, and a girl came up and said, "What'll you have?" And I said, "I'll have a cheeseburger." "No, have cheeseburger." And, okay. And I looked down there and what else they had there. And I said, okay, how about grilled cheese sandwich? No, have grilled cheese sandwich. I thought, oh, okay, this is serious now, you know. And there was something else on the menu, and I said, well, how about that? She said, no, have. And I said, you know, I thought, well, this is not, the, I can go through the whole menu this way, you know. And I said, well, what do you have? She says, have eggs. I said, hey, that's it? You have eggs? She said, have eggs. I said, okay. I thought, well, breakfast, you know, at noon, that'd be okay. So I said, okay, give me 3 eggs scrambled and some toast. And she just got red in the face, and she stomped her foot, and she says, no, have toast, have eggs. And I mentioned in the other slide about munitions shortages. And I remember reading the Stars and Stripes when I was over there. You know, it was about August or September of 66, and the headline was Secretary of the Air Force denies munition shortage. And going out to the airplane, and at that time our standard ordnance load on the Wild Weasel aircraft was 2 AGM-45s, the strike missiles, and 2 pods of 2.75 rockets. So we had 38 rockets, 2 AGM-45s. The single-seat Ds that flew with us normally had a center line with 6 500-pound bombs on there. And going out there and getting ready for a mission, you'd have one strike on the Weasel. Nothing. No rockets. Not 2 strikes, 1 strike. And going over to our D-model wingman and looking at him, instead of having 6 500-pound bombs on there, he'd have 2. And it just broke the crew chief's hearts to give you an airplane like that with that. I said, you know, I asked the crew chief, is this all you got, is 1 strike? He said, yes, sir, that's all they gave us. And so, you know, you were expected to go up and fly the sortie just as you would any other time, but with not enough munitions on the airplane to do the job. I looked up in the archives and found this quote here, which I paraphrased, and it's really craftily worded, isn't it? You know, I mean, you're going up there instead of 70 bombs, you're going to go up there and drop 20 on the target. So the Secretary of the Air Force said, you know, there's a shortage, but it's not keeping our pilots from attacking their targets. Well, that's true. You know, as far as that goes, that's something you'd say to Congress, and Congress would think, oh, well, everything's hunky-dory, when in fact it isn't. You know, you can attack the target, but you're not doing a whole lot of damage because you don't have a whole lot of munitions. The munitions, they were short, but I want to talk to you here a second, too, about the equipment we were given to go find missile sites. You know that the United States Air Force would not send you out to do a job like this without giving the very best equipment that's available. So I want to tell you how great the equipment was. It really was state-of-the-art. This is the radar warning receiver, and these went into most of the TAC fighter aircraft. The airplane is right in the center there, and the strobe going out behind you is something about at your 7 o'clock position. The surface-to-air missile radar are these two strobes right here, one there and one there. It has 2 radar beams. The one has more than that, but for tracking purposes, it has one that tracks you in elevation and one that tracks you in azimuth, and they're both displayed like that. As you can see, they're about 15, 20 degrees apart. So as you look at this, the surface-to-air missile site is either right about here or right about here, and the accuracy of this equipment is plus or minus 17 degrees. So that surface-to-air missile site now might be right here, or he might be over here. So it was sort of an art to try to find the site. So backseat, the electronic warfare officer had some better equipment. He had this receiver here, which is a little more accurate than the other. This is an eye test for you old fighter pilots out there. Where's the same site? I had this slide in my box of slides for years, and I couldn't figure out what the heck I had it for. And um, I want you to imagine this problem. You're zipping along here at about 8,000 feet. You're going about 500 miles an hour. And you're looking out the left window and the right, and you're looking ahead. And you're trying to find where the missile site is. Well, there are some terrain features you can see here, some cultivated fields here. It looks like maybe a river going up through here where the banks have collapsed, where there's fresh earth there. Maybe a village here. Some more cultivated fields over here. But I've made it easier for you because I've readjusted the slide and I put the missile site right in the middle. And there's the missile site right there. This one happens to be unoccupied, but here's a launcher position. There's one there. There's six of them all around the way. And there are revetments in the area in the center here for the vans or the radar vans and things like that. So the point is they're not easy to find, you know, and the equipment is the best we have at the time, but it's not great either. Our standoff missile, I told you, our majors fired these before, you know, when we were in training. This is the AGM-45 Shrike. It was a Navy missile when the war started. We did not have any standoff missiles in the Air Force. And we got some from the Navy on loan. But just to give you an idea of what the geometry is of trying to attack a missile site, here's the missile site is right there, and you're coming in from up here. Here is the outside range of where the guy on the ground can hit you, can shoot at you. That's about 19 miles away from the site. And you have to be sort of creative as you're flying in this area here until you get in here. Here's where you can shoot your missile at him, 7 miles. And here's where your 2.75 rockets can hit him. So it's sort of a, you know, as I say, you have to be a little creative in there about what you're doing. I've got a few letters home here that I wanted to share with you that I wrote while I was over there. This, like I say, we arrived there the 4th of July. This is on the 9th of July. And it was interesting. You know, we were losing people every day. Haven't flown yet. We're not getting free mail here because we're not in the combat zone. So, you know, which I always thought was interesting. We're in the O Club. It's hot outside. 11th of July. Been there 7 days now. Still hadn't flown. At that time, they didn't really know much how to use the wild weasels. And if the weather was bad in the primary target area, usually the wild weasels, they just canceled them out. You didn't go on any easy sorties at the time. And this was, you know, kind of typical letter home. Sitting around, it's getting pretty old. The weather's still hot. The club is out of meat and a lot of other things, and I'm not flying. Other than that, everything's just great. Finally flew. I've got my first mission, only 99 more to go. But it was a dull mission. Went to a secondary target. 14th of July, got myself a library card today. You know? our first loss of our 8 crews happened on the 23rd of July. Gene Pemberton, Ben Newsom, got hit by surface-to-air missile. Buddy Reinbold, another of our Wild Weasel pilots, was flying a D model that day. Got his hand shot up really bad and holes in his arm and had 87 holes in the airplane. 5th of August, 56, finally saw some action. Flew a good one today. Killed 2 SAM sites. This up north flying is the greatest. I can't believe I said that, you know? And I believe I said that. You talk about, you know, testosterone-laden young people, you know? But anyway, I'm going to tell you a war story here. 7th of August, 1966 was a day where we lost a record number of aircraft over North Vietnam. And it was called Black Sunday, when you still read histories from that era. We took off here from Tak Lee, Thailand, went out over Da Nang here, up the coast, refueling with KC-135 tankers in this area. And the targets were a series of targets in here in an area called the Northeast Railway. Very heavy defended area that went from about the Noi area here up into China. A major transportation link where a whole lot of everything, all supplies came in there. That many of them came in that way. Ed and I took off early in the morning, flew up here. We got about here, still on the tanker, and we heard emergency beepers going off. Already two airplanes had been shot down. We headed in over the coast there, picked out a surf-to-air missile site to launch our strike at. We launched the missile, AGM-45 at the strike. It went off the air at the appropriate time. The weather was terrible. Towering cumulus clouds, tops about 40,000 feet, probably 5/10 coverage of the area, and a haze below that. So it was not really a good weather conditions to be hunting missile sites. We turned to go after a second missile site, and just as we turned, the site launched at us. And I called Ed in my calmest voice and said, "Launch!" actually, I said, "We have a launch at 2:00. and Ed pushes the airplane over, lights the burner, and down we go. And the first missile comes by, and Ed pulls up and turns into it, and it goes underneath it, underneath us. Second one comes by just a few seconds later, and Ed manages to dodge that also again. We're running a little bit out of airspeed. We're getting a little bit slow now. The third missile coming at us right out of a cloud bank, and we're about out of maneuverability. There was just no place to go. The missile was right there and exploded and did a real job on the airplane. Okay, now I'm going to ask you to help me with this part of the story here. When I count to three, I want you all to take a real deep breath and hold it. And don't let it out and don't breathe until I tell you you can breathe, okay? Can you do that? Okay. And I'm going to be telling you some story while you're holding your breath, so. Okay, 1, 2, 3, okay. Okay. All right. So here we are in the airplane. And most of the brunt of the missile site hits the gun drum of the cannon. Over 1,000 rounds of 20-millimeter ammunition blew up, took the nose of the airplane off. Could see nothing through the smoke except the fire warning light, which says your airplane's on fire, and the master caution light, which is on also, which says you got something wrong with some of your systems in the airplane. And I couldn't breathe. Didn't want to breathe this cordite because it probably is going to do some serious damage to your lungs forever. Okay, so keep holding your breath. Don't let it go yet. Back here on this back panel is the auxiliary canopy jettison handle. It's a handle that I've pushed many times. And it's got a hinge pin in the middle. You push one end, the other end comes up. You grab it and you pull up on it, the canopy goes. And that's a good thing at this point in time because that means fresh air is going to come in. Don't keep your breathing yet. I can't find it. I cannot find it, and I really, really, really want to take a breath, but I don't dare breathe this crap in that's in the air. Couldn't find it. It's back there. I knew it's there. I used to put my hand on it all the time. Couldn't find it. Okay, I've really got to take a breath. Don't you breathe yet, then. But the other way to get rid of the canopy is by rotating the ejection seat handles. And I had every intention of leaving that airplane at that moment. I thought, the heck with this, you know, no, there's no point sitting here, you know, dying of asphyxiation. So I reached down and grabbed hold of the ejection seat handles and rotated them up. You can breathe now. The canopies go off the aircraft. When you rotate the handles in an F-105, it's a two-position thing. You rotate the handles, the seat bottoms out, canopy goes, and the seat is armed, ready to go. And then a trigger sort of flops loose from the ejection seat, and you've got to actually rotate the handles up and then open your hands and grab the trigger and squeeze it. And I was about halfway through that process of grabbing those triggers and squeezing it, and somebody said, well, maybe you better think about this a minute, you know. And I looked around, of course, the smoke had all gone out. The fire warning light had gone out. You could look out, and you know, you saw blue sky out there and a few white puffy clouds over here, and you know, everything really seemed pretty good there. Anyway, first thing you want to do in that circumstance, I decided I was going to stay a while longer, is in a two-seat airplane, the first thing you want to do is find out if you're by yourself or not. So I went to the call position on the intercom box, and I said, "Ed, you there?" And Ed said, "Yeah, Mike, are you there?" And which only goes to show you that there's some proof to the theory that testosterone makes you stupid. Anyway, Ed says, "I'm going to try to get us out of here." So there we are with an open cockpit airplane doing about 340 knots. Ed headed out towards the coast, and, life was good. I decided to stay there. I looked out. There was a huge hole in the leading edge of the left wing. Top of the tail had been taken off, but at least the fire warning light was out. We head out towards the coast, and we go across a place called Camp Faw. Camp Faw is on the coast. There's iron mines there. There's also an anti-aircraft gunnery school there. So as we're heading out towards, we're getting close to the coast, and I say, "Ed, they're shooting at us." And there was a big circle of black 57-millimeter flak, probably 1,000 yards back. And I said, "Oh, Rods, I got it." And the second burst of 57-millimeter flak was probably about 500 yards back. Third burst went right under the aircraft and jolted the aircraft pretty hard. At that time, our wingman joined up. We had lost our wingman when we were dodging the first surface-to-air missiles. It's really hard to do formation SAM evasive maneuvers, you know. So usually it's sort of every man for himself and try to join up later. Well, Pete Pittman was our wingman at the time, and he joined up. He slid under us and probably had about a 100-knot overtake, you know. So he slid under us, and he slid way out here, and the flak started tracking him out. Well, you know, which was good for us because they'd have hammered us there for sure. The controls went out about that time. We had just crossed over the coast, and the controls went slack. And Ed said, "Well, you know, we need to get out of here." So I went ahead and bailed out, and he bailed out about 3 or 4 seconds later. Got under canopy in the airplane. Looked out and saw the airplane spiraling down, and the airplane was down about 3,000 feet, and it blew up. So the fire warning light had gone out, but obviously there was a fire still burning in there, you know, so it blew up before it hit the ground. Good thing we got out of it when we did. It was interesting. I was really pretty proud of the way I was handling everything. You know, you have a survival kit attached to you, and I pulled the handle on the survival kit, and the kit fell down. It's got about a 1-inch white nylon cord or tape that goes from you to the survival kit, and then another extension that goes from the survival kit to your one-man raft. So you know, you got everything you need there. I pulled released the survival kit, and I looked at that handle, and I thought, you know, that'll make a dandy souvenir, you know. And I put it in my G-suit pocket, and it's hanging on the wall back home still. And all that's left of aircraft 358, by the way. I was pretty calm and cocky that I was remembering everything that I had learned at survival school. You know, and I thought, okay, you know, and I took my radio out. I had we all carried survival radios in our survival vest. So I pulled it out and was listening to the rescue going on, you know, enjoying my first parachute ride, and it was really cool. And went over in my mind about all the stuff that we were supposed to do about landing in the water, because, you know, it was going to be a water landing. And I remember that, the raft hits the water first, because it's the lowest thing. And then you pull on your risers to where you've got your face into the wind. And when your feet hit the water, you release your canopy so it blows off away from you and doesn't drown you. And I thought, Gilroy, you're cooler than John Wayne. I mean, you know, you're really doing great here. So down we go. The raft hits the water. My feet hit the water. I release the canopy. Now I'm going to count to three again, then I want you to hold your breath again. You ready? 1, 2, 3. Okay, hold your breath. Don't breathe now. And I'm sinking like a rock. For a second time today, I'm going to run out of air. I'm sinking like a rock. You know, I've got boots on. I've got G-suit, you know, which has got flares. I've got a big buck general hunting knife. I've got my pistol. I've got flares. I've got baby water bottles. And I've got survival radios. And I'm really, really, really heavy. And I am sinking like a stone. I have forgotten to inflate my life preserver. I'm Mae West, you know. Okay, well, that ought to be an easy problem to fix. Don't breathe yet. And because there are two plastic tabs, one here and one on this side. And either one of them, if you could just find one and pull it, one is the CO2 cartridge from one side is enough to inflate the whole thing. I couldn't find it. Could not find it. And I'm still going down. I'm probably 30 feet underwater at this time. And I really, really, really want to take a breath. And you know that, and I just know that if I do, I'm dead. I'm going to drown right there. And I can't find the things. You know, they had shifted somehow or other during the bailout or something. Could not find them. Was just about ready to take the biggest breath of salt water in my life when the one-inch nylon cord just shows right up in front of my face. And I grabbed that thing and I pulled myself up and I jumped in the raft. You can breathe now. Jumped in the life raft. And had about 30 seconds of self-criticism that maybe I wasn't as cool as John Wayne after all. And but anyway, I was there in the raft and it was safe. I pulled up the survival kit to see what was in there. Supposed to be a lot of things in the survival kit. You're supposed to have a 22 Hornet rifle, you know, in pieces, you know, that with the stock that you can put together, you know, to go, you know, hunt antelope or deer or something like that. You're supposed to have food, you know, pemmican and all sorts of good things to eat. You're supposed to have canned water, a couple extra radios supposed to be in there, survival manual that you can read, you know, as to what to do when the sharks are coming after you. But you're supposed to have shark repellent in there and a sea dye marker and all sorts of good things. Pull up my survival kit, I open the lid, and there are two pair of black wool socks in there. That's it. That's it. Everything else had been stolen out of the survival kit. Two pair of black wool socks. I guess whoever stole the stuff didn't know what to do with black wool socks when it's 95 degrees out and the humidity's 95. So, anyway, I threw that back over the side. And we all carried plastic baby bottles with water in, you know, as our own personal water, you know. So I took one of those out and drank it and got the radio out and was listening to what was going on. And things were looking up again. About 3 or 4 foot swells in the water. I couldn't see my pilot. He was probably 100 yards away or less, but I couldn't see him because of the swells. And we're in the water for about an hour and a half, and here comes an HU-16 out of Da Nang. Now, I didn't know it was an HU-16 out of Da Nang, and it was an HU-16. And this is deceptive here because this is one that says United States Air Force on the side. So anyway, this HU-16 comes in, and I can hear him on the radio picking Ed up, and I haven't set off my flare yet to let him know where I was. As soon as they picked him up, I lit my flare, and they said, okay, we see the other guy, we see the other pilot. I did not take exception to the fact that they were calling me a pilot. I thought, well, it'd be nice to be rescued anyway. But here comes the HU-16 over, and it's camouflaged. And all our planes are camouflaged over there, but they still had a star in there, and they still said U.S. Air Force. This was camouflaged, but it didn't have any of this U.S. Air Force stuff on there. And I was thinking to myself, you know, this is probably some commie trick of some sort. But what had happened, I found out later, was that it was a new arrival airplane. It had gone into the paint shop, you know, to get its, you know, the Southeast Asia paint job on it. And they had to put it on the schedule because they needed an airplane, so they pulled it out before they finished the paint job. So here comes this HU-16 taxiing up with no markings, and I thought, I don't know what country this airplane belongs to. And in the door is an Oriental in a wetsuit. And I reach for my pistol, and this little kid shouts, "Don't shoot, I'm Hawaiian!" No. Well, anyway, we get in the airplane. This is Ed in the raft. This was taken out of the pilot's window of him there. He swears that's me, and I swear I'm bright enough, not to have my hands in the water in the South China Sea that has the highest density of poison sea snakes of any place in the world. But that was Ed, and that picture made the front page of the New York Times, I believe. Ed is badly damaged when he got in the airplane. He had back trouble before, but the seat at the ejection seat of the 105 hits you with 18 instantaneous G's. So if you're a 200-pound person, you've got a 3,600-pound weight immediately on your spine, and hardly anybody does that without getting a compression fracture of some kind. And I got a compression fracture too, T13, I think, and T14. But at that time, I weighed about 170 pounds, so, it was minor damage compared to Ed. Ed never got to fly ejection seat aircraft again. He went flew C-47s after that. But we got rescued and went back to Da Nang. The rest of the day wasn't good. The two that got shot down before us, John Wendell and Will Gideon, were prisoners of war. Ed and I were the only ones rescued. About 15 minutes past us, Bob Sandvik and Tom Pyle, another Weasel crew, went down just on the outskirts of Kep Airfield. Charlie Fryer and Dick Moran were Navy pilots that were shot down that day, and Mike Brazelton from the 354th was shot down shortly after us. Excuse me. Pardon me. An interesting day. It was a record for the most losses, for quite a while. The next day was just as bad. The next day we lost our operations officer in the 354th TAC Fighter Squadron. Some of you may know him, Jim Kassler. Jim Kassler was a major. He's the only guy, I think, that has received three awards of the Air Force Cross. Jim was a very aggressive guy. He was a B-17 or a B-29 gunner in World War II. Was a Korean War ace, and then was our operations officer. We lost another Wild Weasel aircraft on the 12th of August, Davis and Metcalf. They both got out okay, but the airplane had to go to the depot to be damaged. Joe Brand and Don Singer were shot down doing road wrecking, another Weasel crew, on the 17th. And after 45 days of being there, of our 16 people, four were dead, three were wounded, and two were prisoners of war. Not a very auspicious start, but the problems or losses were just as high in the squadron. This was the 354th TAC Fighter Squadron, one of the three squadrons at Tok Lee at this time. There was also the 333rd and the 357th. It says 21 aircraft lost, and does anybody know how many airplanes a fighter squadron usually has? 24 aircraft. So, okay, here, July through December, we've lost 21, okay? Seven pilots or electronic warfare officers were killed. Nine were prisoners of war. Eight were rescued. We had lost two squadron commanders and an ops officer during that time. And these figures are slightly misleading because, as I said, of the ones that are rescued, not all of them are fit for duty. Some of them, can't fly jets anymore because of the ejection sequence. The wing was a little, not quite as bad. As I said, there were three squadrons. The wing lost 40 aircraft during this time, 13 pilots or UOs killed, 16 guys, POWs, and 14 rescued. Now, that was pretty bad, but I'll tell you the reason, I think the reason that the losses were so high at that time, crew fatigue, I think, really played a major part in that. You went up and you had these high stress situations that you went through, high doses of adrenaline, came back, blew off some steam at the bar with a few drinks, went back, got an hour or two of sleep, with engines running, which is not very restful. And I think eventually that accumulates and, you're just a little bit slower in your reflexes or your decision-making process isn't quite as sharp as it should be. But anyway, I want to fast forward now a few months and to another mission on 10th March 1967. And this time we have a lot better leadership. I know in the 354 squadron, we had good guys leading it before, but a guy by the name of Phil Gast came in there. Where before we'd fly the morning sortie and we'd go to the bar and we'd drink all day, Phil said, no, we're going to do a lot of stateside piloting stuff. So, we're going to have everybody got extra duties. I was a maintenance liaison officer. I was a public affairs officer and probably a couple other jobs in there. And so I had a job to do when I got back from flying. You know, I had to go do this job. And we all griped about it because, you know, what the heck kind of a deal is this, you know. But it kept us out of the bars and it got us a lot sharper. We had new quarters. Guys called the Ponderosa down by the main gate were built. Nice brick quarters. Air conditioned. Way far away from the flight line. The hooches were all closed in on the sides and air conditioned, so you know it was you can go in there at 10 o'clock in the morning, and it was dark and it was cool, and they were soundproof, so you could go in and sleep. For the food and the weapon shortages were solved, and I guess one of the important things too is we had enough experienced crews at that time that we could train the new guys coming in. We didn't have to send them to Hanoi the first day by themselves. We could take them as to group package one, or we could put them in our wing and let them get a little experience that way. But this is a group I'm going to talk about here on the 10th of March, 67, the 354th TAC Fighter Squadron. The target on this particular day was the Taiwan Steel Mill. And it's right about there where my shaky hand is pointing, right? About north of Hanoi. There's a Northeast Railway that I said, told you, you know, went up northeast towards China. There was a Northern Railway that went directly north, and that's where the Taiwan Steel Mill. General Mo Meyer, the 7th, the 4-star general in charge of 7th Air Force, in his memoirs wrote about the defenses in North Vietnam and singled out some that were worse than others. The Hanoi Rail Yard, Viet Tri, Taiwan Steel Mill, were three of the ones that he mentioned. Very, very heavily defended area. The 354th TAC Fighter Squadron Commander Phil Gass was leading the mission that day, as well as leading the flight, the flak suppression flight. The Weasel flight was made up of Dave Everson and Joe Luna as lead, Bill Heft as a DE wingman number two. Bill Heft was a KC-135 co-pilot who had been put into fighters, which is a pretty common thing at that time. Merle Deffelson and I, Merle was my third pilot at that time, as number three, and Ken Bell as number four. Ken Bell was on the wing staff. We were all captains, and he was a major. He was going to give us a stand of Al ride for our on this mission. And good luck with that. Huh? So we take off and we head on up from Tokley. We refuel over Laos, go up over here and turn about here, turn and head south, heading towards the steel mill. We just head south and we're about 8,000 feet and we're descending for some reason. We're down at 6,000 feet and I called Morrell. I said we're getting way too low. We're down to 5,000 feet, 4,000 feet, and I said, Merle, we got to pull up. We're too low. Merle is a indoctrinated wingman. You know, he believes in following his leader. You know, if the leader goes into the mountain, the rest of the flight goes in the mountain. I didn't go to pilot school. I went to electronic warfare officer school, and they didn't teach us that. So, anyway, and then we hear two beepers, and Dave Everson and Joe Luna had been hit, and bail out almost immediately. They had been hit actually a little bit back further, but we didn't know it. When we started the descent, they had been hit at that time. And so, anyway, they bail out. We've got two beepers. The strike force is probably 15 minutes from the target still. Bill Heft calls, I'm hit really bad. I've got to, get out of here. Merle and I take over, and Merle tells Bill Heps to join up on somebody coming off the target and go home with them. And we head on in trying to attack the missile site, which was guarding the area, which was just south of the steel mill. I line Merle up on the radar, and we fire a AGM-45 at it, and it doesn't do anything. It doesn't hit anything. I take him in over the target, over the SAM site, and he says, "I can't see it. I can't see it." So I said, "Give me another run in." He turns around, goes back to the right, comes back in. The second run is way too short. You know, I need more time on that. The equipment that you have lines you up in azimuth. It doesn't give you, the range is a very, very iffy thing. You know, on the receiver you have in the back seat, when you go over the site, you can two strobes like that, they'll drop maybe an eighth or a quarter of an inch and then pop back up. And if you're not really, really looking at it, you'll never see it. So, finding when you exactly go over the site is pretty hard to do. The second run was too short. I said, "Merle, I need a longer run." So we went out to the south of the target, turned back in, and as we start heading back in, we're out of the flak here. The flak is ahead of us, what we were. A flight of four MiG-17s comes in on us. And as we enter the flak, they're not having any part of that. And they pull off, and we go into the flak, and that is the worst flak I think I've ever seen. And a lot of the guys who flew in World War II and flew in Vietnam said that's the worst flak they'd ever seen. For those of you that have never, been in that situation, if you've been in a real big hailstorm, where the hail is hitting the roof, or maybe you were even under a corrugated steel roof where the hail was hitting, That's what it sounded like. I mean, the stuff was just, rattling off the aircraft, and some was not rattling off the aircraft. Some was making holes in the aircraft, and really heavy stuff. Anyway, we went through and we made our second homing run. The MiGs broke off. The flak suppression flight with the fuel gas and his crew were just coming off the target. Max Brestel was his wingman. Flight of four MiG-17s is there, and they are coming off, and the MiG-17s are turning there, and Max arms up the gun and shoots down one of them, and is on the radio. Max is a very excitable guy. He swears this is not a true story, but I know it is a true story. He's on the radio. He said, "I got a MiG! I got a MiG!" And Phil Gass was not mission commander was not one for, loose talk on the radio. And he said, "Shut up and get another one." And he did. He did. The only dual MiG kill from an F-105 with a gun in the war. Really well done. Phil Gass got a MiG, too. But anyway, we couldn't find the SAM site that time. I said, "Let's try another run in Merle," and we went back, and there was a function on the equipment that you call, I think it was called manual gate, that you could go to, and you could lock your receiver in the back seat up on one signal and one signal only. And it was made for making training runs at Hawthorne, Nevada, or something like that. So for the fourth run, I locked the receiver into that and sat there, and we drove in until back into the flak again. MiGs jumped us again and went off. And finally went in and on the fourth run found the missile site, bombed it. In the meantime, we did not know, but Ken Bell, our number four, who was our wingman, had taken a hit and an aileron was hanging down. And so he could make left turns and not right turns. But he hung in there and didn't say anything. We got off the target and went back and recovered at Udorn. This is a picture of the airplane at that time. This picture was painted by a good friend of mine, Joe Klein, aviation artist. And I said, "Joe, we need more flak." he was pretty proud of the airplane he painted, so he didn't want to put any more flak on there. But the steel mill was a good mission. Most of you heard of Pardo's push. Bob Pardo, when his airplane was shot up and his wingman too, and he had his wingman drop his tail hook and pushed him out. That happened on this mission. That happened about half an hour after we left. Merle Bethelson received the Medal of Honor. Max Bressel got two MIG kills. Phil Gass got one. So it was a pretty good mission. Glad to be home. You know, we got home. We landed and debriefed and at one of the F-4 bases, and then we're cleared for a one-time flight to get our airplane home to Tokley. That was about the last of my exciting missions. In April, this tall, good-looking guy here is me. And you can, that's landing after my 100 missions. Bob Scott, our wing commander. Phil Gast, there with my 100-mission flight suit. Merle Bethelson. I'm the happiest guy there because I don't have to fly anymore. and my nice flying boots there, you know, elephant hide flying boots. I had the Wild Weasel stencil on my shorts. You change to put on your flight suit, and that's the end of my war stories. But I had some observations to make, and I know a lot of you guys are former military guys and former Air Force. These are some of the observations that came to me after this whole thing was over, you know. Let you peruse them there. The first one there is that, you know, you always have leadership in an organization, but it always doesn't come from the top. You know, the guy with the eagles, you know, that's there, has a wing commander position or the DO position or whatever, even some squadron commanders, aren't always the real great combat leaders. We had first lieutenants not too long out of the Air Force Academy who were probably better mission leads than some of the more senior people. And we always had people that stood up and do a good job. But it isn't always the leaders. It isn't always the guys that have the title of leaders. And the bravest people don't always come out of the war with the most medals. We had guys there. I've read some write-ups of some guys that would come down, and after every mission, they'd write themselves up for a Distinguished Flying Cross. You know, or if they got shot at, they'd write themselves up for a Silver Star. But most guys wouldn't do that. You know, they would not. They didn't give a damn about that. You know, you'd like to have maybe one for your mess dress, you know. But beyond that, but like I say, there are a whole lot of people that come out of there, you know, and you read their resume, and boy, they sound like they're just really some hot stuff. Not so. And the best combat leaders don't always wind up as generals. We had, in the Wild Weasel program, we were pretty lucky, you know, with the generals. We had Chuck Horner made 4 stars. Joe Ralston, Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, made 4 stars. Dick Myers, made Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, all Wild Weasel experienced guys. A lot of the best mission leaders, Billy Sparks, you know, we were talking about Billy the other night, if you really wanted a combat leader who could inspire people to go do great things and then take you up there and do that, the kind of guy who'd, charge hell with a bucket of ice water, you know, those weren't the guys that the Air Force really appreciated. You know, they weren't shiny enough, or they weren't polite enough, or, they stood around and scratched themselves or something, you know, and all that. You can't have that. So, you know, the right guys don't always get the top. You don't always get your combat leader. You know, you get something, in a lot of cases, that's a combination of a business manager and a little bit of leader and something like that thrown in. Loudest talkers don't always have the reason to do so. And I'm a little embarrassed about putting this in at the end about fighter pilots, but I had been, I am right. I had, when I first was associated with fighter pilots, and I spent most of my time after Tokley in fighters, these people were arrogant, you know, they were cocky, self-righteous, know-it-alls, they always wanted the prettiest girl when you went to the bar. There was little redeeming social value, you know. But they turned out to be just splendid people, you know, people you were, proud to be associated with. Guys like I said, you know, about Billy Sparks charging hell with a bucket of ice water. These guys would, to a man, would do that. So, anyway, those are my observations. I mean, you know, I'll take credit for them. You know, don't ask you to agree with them. So that's it. That's the end of my story.